Roll tape.
Speed.
Okay, Alan Bean, Commander, United States Navy, right? Lunar Module Pilot, Apollo 12. Say for me the first, I'm Alan Bean.
Okay, I'm Alan Bean.
Now look at the cameras.
Okay, I'm Alan Bean, Apollo 12 Lunar Module Pilot.
Do it again without the
Okay, I'm Alan.
Whoa, pause so we can get it clean. Look at the cameras. I'm Alan Bean.
I'm Alan Bean, Apollo 12 Lunar Module Pilot.
Okay, fine.
I do it?
Yeah. All right, now. Albine, you've waited a long time to fly. You've been in the program for quite a few years. You were among the third group of astronauts brought into the program. How do you feel about finally going on Apollo 12?
Pretty happy, and I think it's been worth the wait.
Worth the wait.
You said it.
How long have you been in the program?
I've been in since, I think it's February of 1963. And it's been a constant train since then, and it's been most interesting experience anyone could imagine.
Now, many of our listeners can tell from hearing your speech that you're from the Southwest, right? You're a Texan?
Yes, Fort Worth, Texas is my home, and my wife's home is Dallas, so this is pretty much home country to us.
How did you get into flying as a young man?
I had always wanted to be a naval aviator, and when I graduated from high school, I was selected to the NROTC program at the University of Texas. I graduated from there in aeronautical engineering, went to flight training, and then just gradually migrated from flight training to test pilot to the business we're in now.
What sort of airplanes have you flown? A lot of
most of my experience has been in light jet attack, like the A-4D, A-4Es, F-9s. I had the opportunity when I was at test pilot at Patuxent River to fly all the Navy jets, so I've had some experience flying most of the Navy airplanes.
Well, one of the requirements for astronauts selected at the time your group came in was extensive experience in jet aircraft, right?
It was, and in fact, it still is. As you know, the scientist astronauts or the people that we're bringing aboard now that don't have any flight training, we're sending them off to flight school. When you take a look at a lunar mission, it becomes pretty obvious that the majority of your total, let's say 10-day mission, 240 hours, the majority of the hours is spent actually doing some sort of flying skill. We've got 30 hours on the surface on our mission, and if you subtract the 30 from the 244, you end up with a great percentage that's really just stick and throttle work. And to do this, you're going to need a background of flying.
Now, during your period here in Houston with the astronaut program, you've had other assignments. You were on a backup crew for one of the Gemini flights, weren't you?
Yes, I backed up Gemini 10, where John Young and Mike Collins made a couple of beautiful rendezvous. After that, Pete Dick and I backed up Apollo 9, where Jim McDivitt, Dave Scott, and Rusty Schweikert did the first Earth orbital operations of the LEM. In fact, that particular assignment has helped us immeasurably getting ready for Apollo 12 and has allowed us to devote a lot of our training time to the actual lunar surface work that we're going to do. And because we've had such a background in flying the LEM and rendezvousing and many of the things that we're going to do in flight on Apollo 12.
Describe briefly your activities in traveling around and preparing for those flights and this one, how you come and go from Houston.
Our headquarters, of course, is here, as all of us are, at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. And this is our home base. This is where a lot of our training is done. But because the spacecraft are built at North American in California and for the command module, and at Grumman up in New York for the LEM, we spend some of our time during the time when our particular spacecraft is being built in those areas. Now, as we get closer to flight in the command module and LEM go to the Cape and start to be checked out there and erected on top of the Saturn V, move to the pad, then we have to necessarily spend time down there checking out the LEM with the people at Cape Kennedy. So we end up doing a lot of our work in that area. I would say we average about 4 or 5 days a week, either Los Angeles, New York, or like now, and for the last 6 months, usually down at the Cape, working in the simulators there and working with the spacecraft down there.
Then hopefully home to be with your family on weekends.
That's right. It hasn't been that way for the last several weeks, but that's typical when you get very close to flight.
How many children do you have?
I have two. I have a boy, Clay, that's 13, and he's in the ninth grade on the swimming team, and he seems to be doing real well. Pretty excited about the flight. And I have a girl, Amy, who's six, and she's in the first grade, and she's probably more excited than anybody else about the flight.
Do you think Clay may ever want to be an astronaut? Has he indicated
I don't
any?
Know. He hasn't talked about it. I think there's a tendency for boys to not necessarily follow in their father's footsteps, so we'll have to see what he decides to do.
Thanks, Albin, and good luck on the flight.
Thank you.
Is that okay, Pete?
I just wanted to get a lot more because roll camera.
Speed.
Roll sound.
Al, there's greater emphasis in Apollo 12 on this scientific package which you and Pete Conrad will deploy. Would you describe how you take it out from the limb, what it involves, and how you'll set it up?
Okay, as you know, the ALSEP, Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package, is a combination of four or five. I use that word because one of them is a smaller and attached to another experiment that we're going to leave on the moon for forever. But it has a guaranteed lifetime of about a year. So it'll be sending back good scientific information for a year. We expect that it will operate then for another year just as well, even though it doesn't have to. And then after that, we probably won't be using it. But our job then is to put this package out on the surface where it will be best located to gain the information that it needs, that it is able to gather, and in a position where it won't be disturbed when we actually ascend from the lunar surface. You were asking earlier about where it might be put. The ALSEP, as you know, is stored in the sequence bay that's located on sort of the left rear of the limb. And on the last part of our first EVA, we're going to go around to that area, open some doors using a sort of a long cord. Doors will lift up and it'll expose two of the packages. Total weight is about 300 earth pounds or 150 pounds of package. And to use these on the moon and to provide for the ability to deploy them on unusual attitudes, or let's say there happens to be a crater right in that area, we got some booms that will pull the packages out of the hole and actually lower them to the ground. So Pete Conrad and I will go to the area, open the doors, pull out the booms, lower the packages to the ground, take the RTG, which is the radiothermal generator. We'll fuel it with a radioisotope fuel source.
This is the nuclear power supply we've heard
That's
about.
That's right. It's a small capsule not necessarily small, but it's about, I guess, 16 inches long and about 3 inches in diameter. It looks like a thick pencil in those dimensions. Of course, it's a thick tube. We've got a couple of tools that we dismount it from a cask that's on the side of the limb and put it in the RTG. Once it's in the RTG, then it starts creating heat there, just as it has been on the side of the limb, but it's been radiated away, of course, all this time during the flight to the moon, and starts manufacturing electricity or generating electricity.
Now, what's in the experiments package? There are four major experiments. Would you describe those?
Okay, well, combined on these two pallets, then, or two packages, are the four major experiments. The first one we're going to put out is a device called a seismometer, passive seismometer. And as you know, the seismometer is designed with some little accelerometers within it, so it can measure minute motions or impulses of the moon. We use them on Earth, of course, to measure earthquakes, or we use them on the Earth when we want to explore for oil or determine what the core of the Earth is like or some specific area is like. So that's the whole idea. Get one of these seismometers on the moon and get it in operating condition, and we'll be able to detect lunar quakes, if there are such a thing. We'll probably be able to detect landslides and craters if they're close by. We'll be able to detect meteoroid impact if they occur fairly close to the seismometer. In fact, one of the things we're going to do just before we leave the moon, after we get out of our ascent stage, we're going to cause it to impact the moon fairly close to our seismometer so that we can get some good ideas of what's going on in the interior of the moon from a large energy source that impacts a good distance from the seismometer. So that's the first experiment. I think it's one of the better ones.
And how about the other three?
The second one we put out is the magnetometer. The purpose of the magnetometer is to take a look at any magnetic field that is affecting the moon. Now, we know from Surveyor and Orbiter and some of the other measurements that the moon does not exhibit much of its own magnetic field. But we do know that the moon operates in many magnetic fields. For example, it's around the Earth, And when it passes behind the Earth in its magnetospheric tail, that we ought to see a lot of changes or a lot of effects on the moon from this Earth magnetic field. And so we're going to take a look at these phenomena. We're going to watch these for a year, and I think we're going to see some interesting happenings from both the moon and perhaps from the sun and some other phenomena that we mm-hmm. don't even know of about mm-hmm. right now. These are the ones that we can think of. When we finish putting out the magnetometer, our next job is to put out what we call the SIDE, or the Superthermal Ion Detector. Its whole function is to take a look at the ions that are about the moon, charged particles, and determine what they are, how many there are, their mass, their general direction, and just some information about them. Also, we want to associate this with the sun's position and the Earth's position and many other things such as this. This is a relatively easy device to employ. We just put it on the surface, and after we leave it, ground command will kick off some covers and expose some tubes. They'll collect these ions. Now, kind of an adjunct to this superthermal ion detector is a cold cathode gauge, and it's part of that experiment, really. It could be called the fifth experiment. It pulls out from this, from the side, lays on the ground, and using this cold cathode ion gauge, we're going to try to determine the atmosphere of the moon. And by atmosphere, I don't mean the amount of oxygen and nitrogen or whatever else that we have here, but what non-charged particles, what other particles besides these charged ones are in the vicinity of the moon. We'll be able to measure those. We'll be able to measure the charged particles with this. And in the last experiment, which I haven't discussed, which is the solar wind, and we'll be able to then hopefully determine the total density of little particles and come up with the environment.
How about that fourth experiment?
Fourth experiment, the solar wind. Now, this particular experiment looks like a little six-sided ball in a way. It's got sets on the surface. Once again, after we leave, the little covers are removed from some detectors, and these detectors are pointed in several different directions, and the whole purpose of the experiment is to measure the flow of charged particles that emanate from the sun, the solar wind as it's called. Now, these charged particles, we know they exist. We've measured them in space a number of times. In fact, on Apollo 11, you may remember that Buzz put up a solar wind collector, sort of like a window shade. We're going to put one of those up, too, where he collected the discrete particles that came from the sun, actually captured them in the foil, and we're going to do the same thing. But this is going to measure 28 different types and energies of matter coming from the sun. And from there, we hope to not only see what the sun is putting out. We've been able to measure that pretty well with unmanned spacecraft, Pioneers, for example, orbiting the sun. But we'll be able to see how it interacts with the moon. As you well know, as the moon moves through solar space, if you will, there's a lot of effects that are pronounced on the surface depending on the direction of the sun or the Earth relative to where the particular point is on the moon that you're studying. So we're going to see vast differences in solar wind collected at sunrise, sunset. Of course, in the middle of the night, you wouldn't expect to collect a lot of solar wind, but there's going to be some. And the object then is to document this and perhaps get a better understanding of what the environment is on the moon, what the changes have been made on the moon over the last 4 billion years or whatever else, and then perhaps be able to extrapolate some of that data to understand better what the changes were caused on Earth by the same phenomena. This is, of course, the whole idea of ALSEP. Get some instrumentation up there, measure what's going on, look at what the situation is now, try to look back in time and see what has happened over the years, just as we've done on Earth, and then take that information and realizing that the Earth is not exactly like the moon, but some of the principles apply, move them back and try to get some better ideas of what have happened to us in the past.
Now, you and Pete will try to take it out quite a distance from the lunar module, won't
you? We will. Originally, we were going to take it out 200 to 300 feet. But as a result of Apollo 11 and some of the evaluations that have been done since then, we've decided that we probably ought to take it out, or the scientists have, and engineers that think about these things, decided that we ought to take it out about 1,000 feet. That's a pretty fur piece when you're in a spacesuit. So I think we'll try to get it out there, and it depends on the terrain. If it's got a lot of hills and dales and we got other things, we might not get it out quite that far, but we're shooting for that neighborhood anyway.
Good luck. We'll be waiting to see the results in the couple of years to come, Al.
Thank you.
Okay, now let's go in.
Do you need this, the Traverse, other aspects, other activities?
Which one, second EVA?
The
how can we combine it in a little shorter form? Are you going to do two traverses?
Yeah.
One in the first? All right, well, let's lump them together.
Okay,
and
well, I can...
sort of generalize in bringing together the kind of samples and stuff.
Okay, now you want to cover surveyor this time or not?
Let's make a separate little blurb on that.
That's a good idea, because it's got a little more...
I want to keep them kind of short.
All right. Well, why don't I just talk about the general geology we're doing and maybe other things.
Okay. All right. Okay, we're ready?
Just a second here, Brett. Sorry. You'll be right with you. We're switching. I'm sorry. Let's do away with it.
Okay? Roll tape, roll sound.
Al, you're going to be on the moon much longer than was Apollo 11. You will have two periods of extravehicular activity. You and Pete Conrad expect to do quite a bit of geological sampling. Let's just talk about that a bit. During your first period outside, what sort of things are you going to look for and how are you going to move around?
As you well know, our first period outside is going to be devoted largely to ALSEP.
Because the experiments package.
Yeah, actually putting out the experiments package. Then with what time we've got available left, which is, let's say, half an hour, three quarters of an hour, it's hard to tell right now because we're going to try to fit in any available free time we have doing as much geology as we can. We're going to do what we call a documented sample. And what we're going to do here is look around for as many different kinds of lunar rocks and lunar geological features we can see. We're going to take pictures of them, not too detailed, but just enough so that we can remember them, so that people on the scientists here on Earth will be able to reconstruct what we saw and get as many different kinds of rocks as we can. We're going to load these rocks in the rock boxes and take them in with us in the first EVA. And this will be sort of the what was formerly the bulk sample. We're just going to try to get a little more information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second time we get out, our main objective is to do a very good documented sample. And by documented sample, I mean we want to take a look at, once again, as many different kinds of lunar rocks as we can see and many different kinds of unusual lunar geographical features as we can spot. But we want to document them very accurately. For example, if we are going to collect a rock, Pete and I have a sort of skit, or rock dance, as I call it, that we go through. We move over to the rock. Pete steps cross onto it by about 4 feet, and before he steps to this position, he puts down a gnomon. And this gnomon is sort of like a little sundial where we can cast a shadow near the rock, and you can tell the orientation of the rock relative to north or east or anywhere else. And you can also tell the tilt of it, and it also allows you to do some color matching because there's colors on this gnomon. He puts this down near the rock, and then he steps cross sun. I move in then to a down sun position, take a picture. He takes a stereo pair cross sun and then starts to pick up the rocks with his tongs. I then get a sample bag. We put the rock in the bag, maybe a quick discussion about any unusual features.
Which we expect to hear.
Yeah, we'll say a few words. Now, one of the interesting things about lunar surface operations is there is a discrete amount of time that you've got, and it's small. So the question is, what do you want to do with it? Do you want to spend it all describing one rock, or do you want to collect as many rocks as you can and say nothing about any of them? Well, there must be a balance, and what we've been trying to do over the last year of training is to get this balance, and we think we've got a pretty good one. At least it's the one we're going to use.
Now, scientists are right here in the Mission Control Center talking to you and coordinating your activities with you so that they can try to document as much of your activity as possible at the same time, aren't they?
That's right. This is going to be one of the differences between our particular exploration and 11's. And also, I think we'll see it on all the following missions. As the lunar surface operation gets more complex, you're going to have to use the man on the surface to make on-the-spot observations.